This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. 7:19 a.m. Wednesday the 2nd of December. And in about half an hour, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute, on the infighting within Pakatan Harapan. We're also asking you this morning, can Pakatan Harapan remain united? What are your thoughts on this? We did have a poll running on Twitter, but it doesn't seem to be working very well right now, so WhatsApp us your answers instead. 01878988899. But in the meantime, let's turn our attention to KRI's latest report.
Yes, Malaysia's overall health outcomes have shown significant improvements over the last decade. This is according to Khazanah Research Institute's third installment, and it's also the last installment of its 2020 State of Household Report that was released yesterday. And so this chapter really focuses on social inequalities and health in Malaysia, and shows that while life expectancy is on the rise, it doesn't necessarily mean Malaysians are healthier. And so we have some determinants like living conditions and all that that can affect our health outcomes.
Yeah, for example, I think the study found that health status is inversely associated with socioeconomic status, with poor health found prevalent among lower income groups. So I think we're going to be taking a look a bit at more in this study.
Absolutely. So we have on the line with us this morning, researcher and co-author of the report, Naziha Muhammad Noor from Khazanah Research Institute, to give us more thoughts on the findings. Naziha, thank you for joining us. So this study shows that Malaysians may be living longer, but not necessarily healthier. What have your findings shown to account for this conclusion?
Hi, thanks Lynn, Roshan and Noel for having me on the show. So as you mentioned, on average, the life expectancy at birth for Malaysians has increased. For example, a baby girl born in 1970, like 5 decades ago, could expect to live up to about 65 years. Given the living conditions of that time. But a baby girl born today in 2020 can expect to live about 77 years. So that's a big increase of about 12 additional years. But of course, it's not just a matter of living longer. For example, maybe back in 1970, a woman would reach the age of 65, have a heart attack and die because of advancements in medical science. Say now in 2020, that same woman, say she has a heart attack at the age of 65, but we're able to treat her so that she survives the heart attack. But now she lives with a heart disease for the rest of her life, which can stop her from doing certain activities. So ideally, we want people to not just live longer, but also to live those extra years in good health. Instead, what we're finding in Malaysia is that, well, yes, life expectancies for both men and women have gone up, but so has the number of years that people live, but then they live it in poor health. There are many potential reasons for this, but one contributor could be that while we're doing very well in terms of treating and curing diseases, we need to do better in terms of preventing the diseases from happening in the first place. And if we consider that about 70% of our total healthcare spending is on curative care and only about 6 or 7% of our health spending is on preventive care, then, you know, this might be one of the potential reasons why we're not living healthier.
The study also shows that while Malaysia's life expectancy was higher than the Southeast Asian region on average, it is still below that of OECD countries, where we lag behind countries with comparable income levels. What is the reason for this?
Maybe one really useful comparative country for Malaysia is probably actually Thailand. So Thailand back in 1990 has a slightly lower life expectancy than Malaysia. Theirs was about 71.3 years. Ours was 71.9 years. But somewhere in the last 3 decades, their life expectancy grew much faster than ours did. In 2019, their life expectancy was around 78 years, which is 3 years longer than ours. So they've really outpaced us, despite the fact that their GDP per capita is actually lower than Malaysia's. South Korea, too, started with a very similar average life expectancy with Malaysia in 1990. But theirs in 2019 is 7 years longer than our life expectancy in 2019. There'll be a host of reasons for why these countries' life expectancies are growing faster than Malaysia's. But one of the maybe common threads is that these countries have continued to invest very heavily in the health system and have, you know, adapted and reformed the health systems over time, which might also explain why these two countries are amongst the top performers in terms of how they're handling the COVID-19 pandemic, because they've been constantly updating their health systems to cope with new challenges.
So is it the question of about Malaysia, because we've been churning out doctors, right? And we have so many medical schools. And so one would imagine we have a supply of doctors. So why is it that we are lacking healthcare?
So, it's not necessarily that we're lacking in healthcare. As I mentioned earlier, like a lot of our healthcare system, we tend to focus, you know, when we have doctors, when we build more hospitals, a lot of these are very, very important in terms of curing diseases. But perhaps where we need to invest more is actually, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of preventative care. So if we invest more in preventative care, it's things like screening programs, health awareness campaigns, campaigns about, you know, healthy nutrition, those kinds of things can actually just prevent diseases from happening in the first place. And in the long run, this can then also work to reduce the burden that our hospitals and, you know, our clinics are facing.
Right. So having access to healthcare and having good health, two separate matters altogether then. Your study does point to income, occupation and working environment as decisive factors in determining health, the health of a good health, especially amongst lower income groups. Do you think there's enough being done policy-wise to ensure that safe and healthy work environments are provided for?
In terms of policies to ensure safe and healthy work environments, the government has, you know, introduced things like the Occupational Safety and Health Master Plan, which does focus on making workplaces safer and healthier. But they, you know, their key targets are basically in terms of preventing accidents on these occupational diseases from happening. And these policies seem to have been successful in achieving their goals. For example, we've seen that the rate of fatal and also non-fatal work injuries have gone down by a lot. My colleagues at CARE, I have found that in the late 90s, for example, there were about 2,300 non-fatal injuries at work for 100,000 workers. But in 2010, this has gone down to a lot by about only 650 non-fatal injuries per 100,000 workers. But the thing is, work can cause poor health beyond just risks for accidents or injuries, but also through things like work-related stress. Work-related stress can come from things like having low control over your workload or having being asked to do more than what you are able to cope with or having very, very long hours and other things. And experiencing these, you know, high, you know, sustained and high levels of stress because of work can cause people to develop risk factors for other diseases like heart diseases, burnout and depression, which are harder to see in terms of their link to poor working conditions, but are still very important contributors to poor health. And these are the things that we need to look out more for in the future. Makes a case for why we need to have not just more jobs, but also jobs that are considered decent work. Or we risk seeing high prevalences of poor health because of the terrible working conditions for our population.
And Naziha, your study concludes also that to improve the overall well-being of the nation, health inequalities must be addressed. And that means addressing social determinants that seem to be unevenly distributed in society. Now, what are these social determinants and what is lacking in our public policies to address this?
Sure. So social determinants of health basically refer to the concept that our health outcomes are not just the result of our behaviors, like how healthy we eat or how often we exercise or whether we can have access to doctors and hospitals when we need to. It also refers to the social factors surrounding an individual that influences their behaviors, things like their income levels, their work, their education levels, the neighborhood they live in, their gender, and other things. Let's consider, for example, a female healthcare worker who is, you know, part of a low-income family. She has three children to take care of. The days are going to be spent working, coming back home, doing household chores like cooking, taking care of the kids. Would she be able to afford to pay for childcare so then she can take an hour to exercise? Does the PPR area she lives in have a safe and clean park where she can go exercise? Does her work schedule allow her to take time for herself? These are examples of some of the ways that our social circumstances can affect our health, beyond just whether there's a clinic nearby. So in terms of policies, we basically need to look beyond the Ministry of Health to be solely responsible for shaping the health of the population. The Ministry of Housing, for example, needs to also consider whether the social housing they build is also accounts for spaces for people to exercise. Are there shops nearby that sell nutritious food at affordable prices? Is there reliable public transport in the area? We need to consider the health impact of all our social policies, because they can play such a huge role in determining the health of the population.
Thank you so much for speaking with us this morning, Naziha. That was Naziha Mohamed Noor from the Khazanah Research Institute, researcher and co-author of the latest State of the Households report, making the point that there is definitely a multi-ministry approach that's needed to solve this problem. Right now, we're about to head into the 7:30 news, and up next, we're looking at Cyber Monday with Poonam Goyal of Bloomberg Intelligence. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.